This is Iconic.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick, and Becca, and Mark.
Hey!
Hello!
Howdy!
We have a great show for you today. We're actually going to do the first of a two-part series of interviews with new 13th Age authors. But before we get into that, Nick, you want to go through our, I believe we have a new patron.
Yes, we do. Michael joined our patronage this last month as a D8 patron. So he's able to do things like access our outlines that we use for our recordings and get access to the audio that we release before everyone else does. And if anyone else wants to join and become a patron, you're able to do that and do things like participate in polls and discussions and submit questions and maybe even topics or join us for a game of some sort.
Yeah, and we have our next Iconic patron game coming up soon. And then also we have a new show that we launched, Exploring Glorantha, with myself and Evan. And if you are a patron, you get to log on and watch the video live, interact with us, ask questions on YouTube, and then a week later it goes live for the general public. So if you haven't seen that, if you have any interest in exploring Glorantha, figuring out where to start if gaming in Glorantha, you can check out the first episode. It's on our YouTube channel. All right, so jumping into today's topic, first of all, let me welcome our two guests for this episode. The first one is Ben Feehan. He has been on here before. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Hey, y'all. So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And the other guest is none other than our very own Becca. Becca, welcome to the show, not just as a host, but as a interviewee.
Why, thank you for having me.
So yeah, we're going to be talking about the Mosaic books and kind of explaining what they are and talking with these two authors, Ben and Becca, about their chapters, what they're working on, what they're looking at. But just to kind of give you an idea, the Mosaic books are, there are two topics. One is on Drakenhall, the City of Monsters, and the other one is on the Koru Behemoths. And essentially, each book is going to have a different chapter looking at that topic from a different author's point of view. And the idea is we're sort of leaning into the your Dragon Empire will vary sort of half-baked kind of here are resources. You're going to be able to take whatever you like out of each individual chapter and apply it to your game. Hopefully you'll get inspired. You'll get a lot of new information. And you can actually go on to Pelgrane's website. They announced the Drakenhall book. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. But Drakenhall, in case you don't know, is one of the great cities of the Dragon Empire, but it is not ruled by the Emperor or any of his sort of iconic relations. It's ruled by the Three. Specifically, the Blue found a way to get Drakenhall recognized as an official member of the Dragon Empire, and in doing so, put it under the protection and the laws of the Empire. So you have the City of Monsters, where things that are normally on the outskirts of an F20 game are sort of in the center by virtue of this pact that the Blue has made with the Emperor. Now, Ben, you have a chapter in this book.
Yeah.
Your chapter is called
Welcome to the Rubble Hood.
Welcome to the Rubble Hood. There is a lot of great puns throughout this chapter, and I am Drakenhall is definitely going to be looked at from like adventurer to champion tier. That's kind of what, you know, for like your city and your street level games. A lot of the authors leaned into this sort of noir feel, but let's start off with this. What is a Rubble Hood?
Well, basically, I was leaning into the fact that it's pretty easy in fantasy or sci-fi stories to go really big, to go really high level, and, you know, talk about, you know, things like on a planet scale. You know, we have in Star Wars, you have Coruscant, the city planet, and you go to Mos Eisley on Tatooine, but basically the whole city is just a desert planet. It's really easy to talk in really broad sweeping strokes when you're talking about fantasy or sci-fi. And so my idea was something like the Rubble Hood. So we were given a chance to talk about Drakenhall, which is a really unique city in and of itself, but get down even a little smaller and start to talk about where do the people actually live? What do they actually do? What does it actually look like to live in Drakenhall? And as it happens, for most places, you know, you're not most people in most cities are not terribly interested in, you know, the activities of the icons, as it were, of you know, or what the Blues up to today. You're mostly interested in, you know, what's for dinner and how you go about making sure that you actually get dinner. I've been actually watching my way through The Wire, and that's actually a perfect example of that. You know, the folks that are living there in the projects in Baltimore in that show are, you know, they're very focused on their neighborhood. You know, the police officers are high level. They know about East and West. But if you're in East or West, all you really care about is East or West. You know, you are talking about your neighborhood. So sort of putting a fantasy spin on that and sort of drilling down, and what does it actually look like to live in one of these neighborhoods? And what are some of the unique rubblehoods that exist within Drakenhall?
Now, they call them rubblehoods because Drakenhall used to be High Rock. And
exactly.
Then it was destroyed. And the Blue is not as concerned with rebuilding all of the city, just the pieces of the city that are important to her.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. There's a lot of room in there to sort of get unique, in the sense that monsters are. The other day, someone made the comment, I think it was actually at Gen Con, someone made the comment that most monsters you only really, in a campaign, see like once or twice. You know, you might even only see them once or twice in a whole campaign. So being able to sort of describe or imagine a neighborhood where these monsters live on a day-to-day basis was a lot of fun. And just sort of, you know, going at it from that perspective.
Ben, why did it appeal to you?
Yeah, well, I think probably basically my first exposure to fantasy outside of Lord of the Rings was Terry Pratchett. And all of Terry Pratchett's stories are about, they're about people. And probably the best way to describe Terry Pratchett is he's someone who loves humanity. And that's what all of his stories are ultimately about. And most of his stories take place inside of a single city, the city of Ankh-Morpork, which I'm sure somebody somewhere out there would pronounce it differently, but that's how I pronounced it. No. I only recently realized it was a satirical take on the city of Lankmar.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. I think you and I have been talking about that.
Yeah, so the idea of being able to, you know, sort of dig into a fantasy city and its general quirkiness and the sort of divisions that you would find there was something I was super familiar with and super super interested in doing. The first couple of ideas I pitched to JM were much more Pratchettian, I guess. There was almost a sense of we were going to, you know, recreate something like the Watch series, which is probably my favorite of his multiple series set in the city. We ended up going a different direction, which I think was probably ultimately better. But yeah, that's sort of where that came from.
Yeah, so it's one of the things that has been interesting about working on this project is working with authors and saying your initial idea is good but out of scope. How can we reform it into something here?
Ben, it sounds like you put quite a bit of effort into this chapter, and I'm really looking forward to being able to dig into it and see what you've done. I'm a big fan of puns, and so I'm excited about this chapter.
Well, I hope I don't disappoint. A lot of it is in the way of references. Like, forget it, Jake. It's the Rebel Hood.
Yeah.
Things like that. So.
So other than all of those cool puns that I'm going to be looking forward to, what other things did you put into the chapter that you're excited about?
Well, I actually spent a lot of time digging into icon hooks for each of the different Rebel Hoods. So there's, how many did I end up doing? Like 7 or 8, maybe even more, actual unique Rebel Hoods that we went into and created hooks for, and characters and NPCs, things that you can actually play with. But on top of that, we went back through and basically you could treat it as a roll table, or you can just treat it as inspiration, essentially a table for each of the different icons and how they might have interest in each of these Rebel Hoods. If you actually look at the original 13th Age core book, one of the comments that they sort of make about the Blue's relationship with the city is that she's not actually as interested in the Rebel Hoods. It's not somewhere where she, you know, pays a lot of attention to. So building off of that idea, that's actually a space where almost in a sort of a Cold War detente sort of idea, this is a space where the other icons might actually be able to have an influence within the Blues city, is in the Rubble Hood, somewhere where she's not going to immediately notice their activity. And so they might actually have some interests. The Rubble Hood of Nolberg is run by gnolls. It's pretty effectively a hellhole. They have imp fighting tournaments here, and they also have a yearly poker tournament here. And you know, like any good spy story, there's always shenanigans and espionage and under the table activity that you can do at a high stakes gambling activity that the entire empire shows up for. So that was just one that we used, that you can use as a plot hook for a number of different things. I went to some effort to make sure that and I think this is probably true in keeping with the intention of the Mosaics book, nothing is nailed down. Like, take what you want, leave the rest. If you want to say that Nolberg is in fact an actual hellhole, you can. If you don't want to, if you want to say it's the hub of the international imp collecting society, I mean, there's seeds for that there. So yeah. But I really enjoyed basically finding a way that each of the icons is actually interested in the Rubble Hoods.
That's awesome.
See, so you said that the Blue doesn't really care about the Rubble Hoods. I think she has her own spies there feeding false information to all these icons. I'm already hooked on it.
I mean, that would be in keeping with the theme, in the sense that she does in fact, yeah, this is her city. It would seem odd if she didn't have exactly mm-hmm. something of that nature going on there. And you know, even again with the core book, you already do have, you know, the names of her secret police and so on. So that would be, you could very easily tie all that together.
Yeah, and you did a lot of work going back through and making sure that every icon had 8 to 10, I think is what it actually ended up being, hooks that GMs can just make either rumors, or they can say, hey, you are an agent of the priestess. Here's what her organization is asking from you on this five. You're calling in an icon relationship with a five. Go to Ben's tables here in the Rubble Hoods and go, well, what do they want in return? Oh, well, the priestess definitely wants you to go X, Y, or Z.
Ben,
yes.
In that, making all these charts, was there one icon that was particularly easy to, or one that was hair pulling and difficult?
That's a great question. Probably the hardest was someone like the Orc Lord, or I think it's probably like the Orc Lord or the Lich King. And mostly because one of the key themes around the Rubble Hood is basically the fact that the whole reason that Drakenhall sticks together is because these monsters, regardless of being monsters, actually do want to continue living. So they don't make trouble for each other. I mean, just like you go out in the wild, you don't see tigers and bears fighting all the time, because they recognize that, you know, in the wild, an actual injury is going to probably result in an infection, which will result in your death. So they might actually be able to share the same space, not comfortably, but they're not going to start anything. So kind of diving into off of that fact, someone like the Orc Lord, who seems like, or like the Lich King, who has sort of the ultimate demise of the empire in mind, that's sort of antithetical to this whole sense of what Drakenhall's about. So that took a little more doing. Probably the easiest to do was actually it was either the Prince of Shadows, because obviously there's always something you can do. There's always a con that you can run somewhere in there, or the High Druid. The High Druid was easy on account of the fact that, as far as cities go, since she, at least according to the core book, really despises cities, it's pretty easy to despise Drakenhall. Like, this is all the worst things you can possibly imagine about a city in one place. So that one was pretty easy to pull off.
I'm really excited about, I'm going through development on that now, and I'm excited to see how people react to all of the individual chapters, as well as, specifically to your chapter, Ben. We worked back and forth quite a bit on getting that focused and tied in. Now, both of you are working on the Koru Behemoth's book, the Mosaic book. And so that's, in case you are saying, JM, what's a Koru Behemoth? I somehow missed that in the 13th Age Koru book. They're the giant creatures that their migration path is that border of the Dragon Empire. And this is going to be geared more towards champion and epic tier, with a look at a number of different ways to both use behemoths, set adventures using behemoths, ways to use behemoths, that sort of thing. So, Becca, let's start with your thing. You really kind of were captured by the idea of the behemoth graveyard.
Let's say, yeah, I was really captured by the idea of death. I was in a good place. It was fine, guys. I got into just my brain, essentially the elephant graveyard from The Lion King. That idea of a place where people don't go because what is there? And so, yeah, it's these core behemoths are so large, so massive, and so integral into the life of the empire that what happens when one of them dies? And did you know that they could die? The powers that be all kind of gain this insight that one of the behemoths is dying, and then it comes out that there's actually two of them that are dying. And so it goes from a, oh, this must be the natural cycle, to something more hinky is going on. You need to go check it out. So yeah, I don't spend a lot of time in the empire with the behemoths. I spend time along that outskirt as these behemoths kind of travel to the very, very edge where something has called them.
So would it be a spoiler if I asked if there's already other remains of other behemoths where they're going?
It's not a spoiler. I mean, yes, there are. There are so other remains.
So that means this has happened in the past. Fascinating.
It has. And so one of the places that I created was a pair of towers carved out of the tusks of a behemoth.
Mm.
And one of the towers has collapsed. Not only has this behemoth been dead long enough for people to claim and inhabit the towers, but then it's been long enough that those towers have become abandoned and destroyed.
I dig it.
Okay, so a question that kind of immediately comes to mind, and maybe you'll dive into this, is why hasn't the Lich King raised a stampede of undead behemoths to take over the Dragon Empire? Granted, every Dragon Empire is different.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So in yours, what has prevented the Lich King from doing this?
It has been more of, well, if we have that the Lich King was the Wizard King, before... there's a good possibility that he is trying to keep things evenly balanced. Maybe he didn't know exactly where it was, because your adventurers have to follow one of the behemoths to find this place. I did something similar to Ben. I heard that he was writing up plot hooks for each icon, and I went, oh, that's a great idea. I only did four for each icon. But yeah, the Lich King, I did kind of write, this is a no-brainer. The Lich King wants to know exactly where this is, and you need to make a portal so that the Lich King can access this.
Or in reverse, stop the portal from being sort of opened up.
That's what the first thing that came to my mind is like, well, I mean, that seems awfully large. Like, this could go very wrong.
But I mean, isn't that the point of heroes? You step in when things have gone almost too far to be stopped, or beyond, like it's too late for anyone to intervene, and that's when heroes show up.
That's when the Lich King turns into Dr. Doofenshmirtz and shows up begging your assistance.
Right.
And I see that's where the being prime for champion and epic tiers is, because by the time the adventurers get through the adventurer tier, they've usually mucked things up and there's some cleanup that has to be done. Mm-hmm. Now
so you touched on it a little bit, but so why did dying behemoths versus live ones really appeal to you versus just saying, hey, I'm going to, you know, because there's several examples in the book already of, you know, the dolphin and high clan of the groups that live on behemoths. And there's still a bunch out there that are not named and they don't know much about. And did you tie in anything about peoples or the civilization that lives on those behemoths and what they're, do they know that behemoth is dying? And
So one of the behemoths is called Mammoth, and the people who live on Mammoth are called Fleas. Yeah, there's a civilization there. They revere the High Druid, and the head shaman is then going to help guide this creature to its death, because they believe it's just a natural cycle, part of the cycle. The reason why you kind of get the sense that it's not so natural is that Slither, a snake-like behemoth, is also heading in this direction, and there are a group of air pirates who kind of anchor to Slither and follow Slither around, also heading in that direction. And so I have the fleas and then the air pirates. And then I also have a group of dragonborn cleric, led by Mother Charity, who are kind of at that last known place at the Dragon Empire, where this is the last time you're going to see civilization before you go too far into the desert and you find the graveyard. So yeah, so I have three groups of people that interact with the behemoths in three different ways. And so if your group is known to like plunder and kill people, maybe you don't want to introduce them to the fleas, but introduce them to somebody else who's going to, you know, rob and plunder like the pirates.
Yeah.
But yeah, what drew me to it, I guess I was just thinking about following the behemoths, and it was just kind of one of those, but do they die? And if so, since they are so magical and powerful and long-lived and giant, what does that look like?
Did anybody touch on like reproduction? Like, okay, they're gonna die. Is there gonna be a new baby behemoth born? Like, is it gonna be so many in the world?
I think that's one of the questions that one of the icons is asking, is saying, all right, go check out where they die, because if they die, does that mean they also come from there, or what?
Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to seeing your write-up on air pirates. That has hooks galore, regardless of the icons. Other than that, and like you said, the at least the four hooks per icon, are there any other cool things that you put into the chapter?
We had recently done our review of the Book of the Underworld. So there's a place in this behemoth graveyard that connects to the underworld, if you're looking to then go into that book. And I also pulled just a couple of different things, like the magical substance known as True Earth that was discussed in the Book of the Underworld. The High Druid wants you to plant, to find a grain of True Earth and plant something near the graveyard so that she can get better access to it. So I really enjoyed looking through all the different 13th Age books I have access to and finding things to say, okay, here's something, if you have this book or if you're interested, you can go in this direction from my one spot. Here's a way to connect more books if you would like.
So Ben, why don't you give us a brief overview of what your look at behemoths is going to look at?
Yeah, basically at the moment, I sort of went the exact opposite direction of Becca. And as opposed to looking at the sort of life cycle, we sort of dug into, I guess maybe the best way to put it is whether or not, I mean, obviously in a fantasy world, we've heard this said before, but there are no atheists in a fantasy world. I mean, the work of the gods is undeniable in a fantasy world. But I think, on the other hand, we also often lean into the fact that, you know, adventures are special, wizards are special, their magic is honestly kind of rare. Otherwise, things start to get out of balance a little bit. On the other hand, so, you know, for example, you know, your average, you know, dishwasher down at the tavern has probably never actually seen magic more than maybe once or twice in his whole life. He's probably never met a talking sword. He's probably, never encountered a one-of-a-kind monster. It's relatively rare. That said, he has almost certainly seen a behemoth if he's anywhere near the travel route. So in a lot of ways, it's sort of that, that this is undeniable mythological magic happening before your very eyes. So sort of leaning into that concept, and one thing that I was sort of thinking about as I was digging into this is like, there's a lot of things like that actually in our real world that we lean really heavily into the explanations of them. For example, I know like Nick climbs mountains, and you guys are mostly in Colorado, so you guys have mountains all around you. And there's a big difference between sort of seeing the mountain in the distance and then actually climbing the thing and, you know, getting to the top of it and sort of the feeling that you get at the top of it and sort of the perspective that you gain, not just in, I mean, and to the point where all the other stuff that you know about it, you know, the tectonic uplift and the aeons of glacial carving and the, you know, all of that, sure, that's interesting, but you know, you suddenly, I guess maybe the best way to put it is you're suddenly experiencing in the most human observable way, eternity, right? This is a thing which has existed for aeons before you. This is a thing which is going to exist for aeons after you. In some, it really helps you get some perspective as far as who you are and where you stand in the universe. And in a lot of ways, sort of looking at the behemoths as almost like that living mountain. And so in a fantasy context, sort of looking at them and recognizing them as, okay, these mythical, magical beings, these creatures that have existed for time immemorial without any real explanation, and sort of digging into that idea of them as magical creatures and what that means, especially to the magic people, as it were, of the Dragon Empire and the world of 13th Age. So, you know, looking at things, so, you know, obviously, but at this point, somebody somewhere has done the whole, you know, light fantastic thing from, again, Pratchett reference. And I'm certain, to answer like Mark's question earlier, crawled along underneath a behemoth, staring up, trying to see how this thing poops or, you know, or reproduces. And it has, I mean, given that apparently, according to the core book, these creatures eat invisible pockets of life energy that they encounter somewhere along the track, these things are obviously not of this natural world. I mean, they're not pooping, and maybe they have the other plumbing, but these things are obviously not of the natural world, and you'd be able to tell that pretty easily. And so sort of digging into that and sort of digging into, so where do they come from? Digging into some myths, like, for example, you know, one thought is, maybe they are the cattle of the gods. Almost all mythologies around the entire world have some creature pulling the sun across the sky, right? Mm-hmm. You have the goats, you have the, you know, the Apollo's chariot and his horses. You know, sometimes it's, you know, a giant dung beetle. So, for example, so, okay, this is a creature that is apparently tireless, walks constantly the same track, and is, you know, just keeps going, walking no matter what. That sounds like a behemoth as described in the core book. So your high priestess or some of her adherents might look at the behemoths as, well, these are the cattle of the gods. These are the creatures that, you know, when the world was first made, they pulled the celestial plow across the universe, behind which the gods sowed all of creation. And then, you know, they left them here to graze, as it were. And so you have, you know, theories like that. You have other theories where, you know, I'm developing where you might say this, they're like those, well, those little critters that live at the bottom of the Marianas Trench, down around those pockets of geothermal energy. Of, you know, they can only survive right next to the vents. These creatures walk the same path. They eat these invisible pockets of life energy. Maybe they're a sort of parasite that exists walking the world. But all these things are sort of just secondary to, begin, wizards and other magic users wondering, how can I either take advantage of the behemoth, or how can I follow in the behemoth's footsteps? And, you know, perhaps using the behemoth, I too can find these pockets of life force, which will allow me to live forever. Or, you know, be able to, what else happens around the behemoths? If they are, in fact, the chariot of the gods, what does that tell me about, or the, you know, they pull the chariots of the gods or the cattle of the gods. What does that tell me about the future? Maybe there's something I can divine from the dust that rises from the behemoth's footsteps, things like that. So sort of leading into the immortal mystery of the behemoths, which I guess to a certain extent, if you were leaning into that and then suddenly they started dying, that could be, to circle back around to Becca's chapter, that could be pretty horrifying. Like if in fact these creatures are supposed to be immortal and suddenly you watching them die, that would be that could be some significant theological damage going on there.
So would it be like sconomancy, the knowledge of the divination by way of dust?
I sort of imagine, I mean, given that there's all kinds of critters that follow like the elephants or the, you know, the wildebeest out on the Serengeti eating just the bugs that are kicked up in the dust. I sort of imagine there must be some sort of critters that do that with the behemoth as well. Maybe even they're, maybe they're just wizards. Just, that's their thing is just following them around, trying to figure out what's going on.
So do you guys have any questions for Ben about his chapter?
What are it sounds like some great questions that Ben's bringing up. I'm kind of thinking just hearing him talk that maybe they walk around in a counterclockwise. Like I said, if they're there from the gods, they're what makes the world spin.
Yeah.
And if they all die, the world stops spinning and bad things happen.
Yep. I actually had that exact thought. Sort of. And one of the things that I was like thinking about was like, okay, think about something like the Buddhist prayer wheel, you know, or, you know, some, or like even like a pilgrimage where that you see in where they walk a specific route in honor of specific events. And so, you know, maybe digging into that a little bit. So exactly that, yes, that they, like, I know some, in certain Christian traditions, they talk about the prayers of the saints that, you know, preserve all of creation, that to a certain extent, maybe these behemoths are these celestial beings, which their constant walking of this path is preserves creation. It's sort of that prayer wheel that they're walking and doing that. So yeah, exactly that, Mark.
I really appreciate your kind of a broad spectrum overview of your contribution to this chapter, and I'm looking forward to digging into it and actually seeing how those concepts end up getting played out with icon hooks and so on and so forth. Based on what you're describing, it sounds like there's going to be a natural connection between the behemoths and the overworld. Is that a valid observation?
I think so. I'm still sort of digging into that. And trying to figure out, you know, what other connections there might have.
Are they little, it could be, microcosms of the Dragon Empire, orbiting the Empire as kind of maybe nascent new regions? Because we don't really know much about what happens beyond the Dragon Empire, and that's out of scope of basically. But
so, like baby continents, like
yeah,
they eventually splash into the water, float away, and turn into Australia.
Yeah.
Are you planning on tying in all your different icon hooks again?
You know, that I was thinking maybe not, but now that I hear that you're doing it, I mean...
Right? Everyone's doing it, Ben.
And part of my initial thought was just to do it with, like, the magic heavy ones. But on the other hand, the more I thought about that, the more, you know, there's basically none of the icons that are really unaffected by that.
Right.
You know, the emperor has to have connection to it. I mean, for goodness sakes, if these things are holding the world together, I am certain the gold worm has some say in their mm-hmm. continued progress. So probably I will. I mean, hopefully I'll make it a little bit, a bit less involved. You know, it won't be an extra 10,000 words or whatever it ended up being. But but yeah, I would definitely think that would probably be something I should be. Make sure it happens.
Well, awesome. Ben and Becca, thank you for sharing with us your insight into your chapters of the Mosaic book. In 2 weeks, we're going to have Liz and Anne-Marie, who are also contributing to the Drakenhall and the Behemoth books. And we're going to talk with them about their contributions. So to all of our patrons, as always, thank you for your support, your continued support. Check out Becca's 13th Age game on the Iconic Production channel. It is wrapping up, right? You've got 5 or 6 more sessions and then all of your players will be dead. I mean, all of their characters will be dead. I mean, the campaign will be over.
Well, you guys were talking about an adventure tier. You make all the mistakes. Yeah. The world might be ending.
Thanks for playing in my world then, Becca.
Write it all down.
We also have Josh's It Gets Worse game, which continues to get worse. So if you like that trend, go check that out on Friday nights. You can check out Mark and Becca and myself on the Ulysses International channel on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Mark and I play in their tour game. Becca and Mark and I are playing through Myth right now, The Lost Barrow, which you can go check out on DriveThruRPG, which I wrote the adventure for, and I'm pretty proud of it. So go ahead and check that out if you like. And we will see you in 2 weeks. And until then, good gaming. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron / Iconic Podcast. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706. And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes. Thanks for listening.